In 1978, when I prepared tape number 102 on discoveries of the caves of the 1,000 Buddhas in the eastern sector of Chinese Turkestan, it was impossible to get into China, or extremely difficult. And in the years that I prepared and was aware of the great discoveries there at Dunhuan, the cave 1,000 Buddhas, I ached very, very greatly to get into the Chinese areas and to find out what happened to many of the clandestine documents that had come out of Dunhuan, the cave 1,000 Buddhas, following the removal by steam, aerial steam, of some 25,000 documents. There had been word that 10,000 other scrolls, averaging about 75 feet in length, had come into Peking and into Tokyo. When the opportunity came in 1981 for me to go to China and Japan to further research and follow through on these marvelous discoveries, I took every advantage of that opportunity. And by way of background, in Japan in 1947 to 1949, I had helped open up the Japanese mission and had been with President Clissold, who had been the president of the Japanese mission, on the day that he had selected an area in Tokyo for the mission home, which later would be the site of the Japanese temple. He said they would build a temple in Japan. There wasn't even then a saint, not even a member of the church, or at least not on the rolls. And so certain was his certainty that I desired to contribute, to be the first one to contribute to the building of the temple in Japan. The years have gone, and in the early part of 1981, they dedicated the Japanese temple. So it was with great fulfillment that in Japan, that the president of the Japanese temple in 1981, Reverend Anderson, to conduct me through the veil. And the individual on the other side of the veil was a former member of the Japanese Air Force. I had been a member of the American Air Force going into Tachikawa following the occupation of Japan. Little did I realize that nearly 35 years later that I'd be conducted to a temple in Japan by a former member of the Japanese Air Force. I understand, too, that the individual who guided me through the veil that day had been a pilot who had made a passing run on the temple in Hawaii, and three times had failed to unload his armament on that official-looking building. Later on, he found out it was the Latter-day Saint Temple. It apparently played a role in his conversion to the church. I had been through many of the bookstores along the Ginza and other places in Tokyo, gone down to Kamakura. I had several objectives in mind. One, I wanted to find information on the Buddha, some more biographical material. I wanted to find information on the first 1,000 years, in fact, the first 300 or 400 years of the Buddhist movement. I wanted to find more information on Dunhuan, the cave of 1,000 Buddhas, and on the documents that had come into Japan from the discoveries made there behind one of the great Buddhas. And then I wanted to go into China. I'd passed a particular bookstore in the Nuatani Great Hotel, and it had fascinated me because right there in the window, there had been advertised a copy of the paintings from Dunhuan. It was very expensive, and I wasn't interested in the paintings as such, but more in the archaeological interpretation and other related aspects, and in the documents themselves, from some of the documents that were found, and not in the cave sculpture. But I did go into the bookstore and browsed around, and I did find that day a book by Ikeda called The Living Buddha, an interpretive biography, one of the best I've ever read on the life of Buddha. I could recommend it to all readers. It's a very interesting book and removes a great deal of the mythology surrounding Buddha. On another visit to that same bookstore, because something drew me to it, I found another book along the same lines that I'd had in mind. This one dealt with Buddhism, the first millennium. And so I was very satisfied likewise with that particular discovery. And as I look at it now, I still have the change that I got in that store in Japan, in Japanese currency. I noticed, however, as I examined the shelves and the bookstalls, that high on a shelf was a book called The Arts of China, New Researches. It didn't appeal to me at the moment, but something drew me to it again. And when I returned a third time to this same bookstore, the impression was to get a ladder and climb up there and see what that book was all about. The cover was sort of window burned. It had apparently been in the window of a bookstore somewhere. Certainly not the Tawny bookstore, because it was exposed in the interior of the great hotel. But somewhere it had been exposed where it was sun bleached. And one inch line across the cover of the book still retained its color. The rest had been bleached out. And so the book was available inexpensively. And when I examined and opened it, I was stunned. It was the book I had been looking for. Arts of China, Volume 2. It wasn't Volume 1. Only Volume 2 contained the material on the Buddhist cave temples. I couldn't have asked for something more specifically than this. So now I have in my hands the book on the Arts of China, the Dun Yuan Caves, their wall paintings, and an update on Buddhist shrines in China and the archaeology and background. Having been successful, at least to a great degree then, because its contents brought me up to date in terms of the organizations and what had happened after 1944 in particular, and after Pilo in 1907 had ventured into the caves of Dun Yuan right after Ariel Stein had removed the materials from the great Buddha vault. Now my next effort was to go into China. So from Tokyo, we went to Shanghai, and with the permits that we had, we were able to get into the various cities of China. And during the period that was in China in the spring of 1981, I was able to visit most of the very ancient cities of China. Peking was not entirely productive as such, even though one of the great Buddhist centers is not very far from Peking along the Great Wall. And though we made a pilgrimage to the Ming tombs and other areas and inquiries and picked up some literature and things of use, I did not find exactly what I had in mind, nor did I get the edification that I had hoped for in Peking itself. Finally, sometime later, we were in western China, in the city of Qian. Here, a great, huge red wall and gate exposed in the directions towards the Lopnor Desert and the great Taklamakan area and the mountains of the Himalayan Plateau. So let me give you a little background to understand what happened in Qian. The great Taklamakan Desert extends across the southern half of the Hsinchin, the Uyghur Autonomous Region between the Tian Shan and the Kunlun Ranges. Tian Shan are the celestial mountains which are along the southern edge of the Russian territories, and the Kunlun are the mountains north of Tibet. These two great ranges of mountains stretching east and west form the great heartland. In between these mountains is a huge desert. It's 1,200 miles long, many hundreds of miles wide. This is the Lopnor Desert, the Taklamakan Desert. At various points, there are oases along the north and south borders of the desert where wealthy cities and small kingdoms have once flourished. The caravan routes that linked these continued in one direction to faraway India, and another through Iran to the Mediterranean world. This so-called Silk Road route had carried Chinese silk to the west as early as 200 years before Christ. In the other direction, transmitted Indian materials and supplies, and Buddhism itself went to China. Dun Yuan, city in the northwest corner of the Gansu province, is a desert haven that served as the Chinese entrance and exit for this great cultural artery. Near it was the often mentioned Jade Gate, or the Yan Barrier, and the various towns west of the Rialto River. This road ran to reach the town capital, Chian'an, and Qian. The great city of Qian, one of the five oldest cities of China, was our resident for a period of time. And here was the gateway through which an individual all of us are familiar with had arrived in China after having traversed the Mediterranean area, clear through the Turkestan area, the Lopnor Desert, camped at Dun Juan, within a few hundred yards of where the vault was located, where the great treasuries were located, and finally arrived where the caravans were outfitted and began their initial long journey, the city of Chien. The man was Marco Polo. The Dun Juan commandery was established during the reign of Watui, of the former Han. This is very early, back around a short period after the time of Christ. Later, during the first confused period of barbarian rule in the north, it was controlled in turn by what they call the former Lin and the former Qin. This is about 300 A.D. up to about 439 A.D. This was the period when the great cave centers of Dun Juan were established. It was there that Buddhism, after leaving northwest India and passing across Central Asia, you've all heard of the Kashmir Pass and those places, Khotan, made its entry and become firmly implanted. The alternate name for Dun Juan is Shashao. In the 11th century, barbarian incursions by the Ugars, these would be Turkish and Afghanistan peoples today, and the Hissi began until the latter overran Dun Juan in the year 1035. And from then on, there was a period of inactivity. In fact, cultural activity came to a halt in the area. Sometime before this invasion in the 11th century, thousands and thousands of documents were taken and sealed up behind a three-story Buddha in a vault that was not to be reopened again until about 1906. Ariel Steen, a cartographer and a geologist and explorer like myself, racing some of the Russians and Germans who had also obtained word that the vault had been found and there were great documents, was the first to arrive. And in tape 102, I give an account of that activity, the discovery and recovery of the great documents at Dun Juan, involving a total ultimately of 35,000 scrolls, about 75 feet long on the average. I have photographs of a number of these. During the period following Steen's activity, in fact a year later, the Frenchman Pilot was able to gain access and he brought back some documents. Then Warner, 1923, and then in 1925, likewise Warner. However, from that time until Second World War, there was only some work undertaken by the Chinese themselves. During the liberation, 1949, the importance of the site as one of the nation's greatest cultural creations was finally becoming recognized. Then there was formed, and this is one of the things that I learned in Japan and China, the Dun Juan Cultural Research Institute. It actually was established in 1944, was reorganized in 1951, and became a center for vigorous activity. What called the world's attention to the existence of Dun Juan was primarily the discovery of three great groups of caves, nearly 1,000 grottos in all. Some of the Buddhist carvings in these caves reached 9 stories high, 2 at least of that size. They were the largest, and from the proximity to the towns were some of the most extensively involved in the conveyance and cultural rituals of ancient Buddhism and other sects. The Chinese, however, now call the area Mo Cao. This is located about 25 kilometers southeast of the distant the district town of Dun Juan itself. The cliffs rise more than 120 feet high and stretch for nearly a third of a mile. There are hundreds and hundreds of caves and many, many grottos. The sculptures have been photographed, the grottos carved, and plastic overlays taken. Images, clay images and things of this kind which were set in ancient niches and altars and platforms have been partially reconstructed. The Chinese eventually will permit access by Westerners to the area when they cease to be embarrassed about the lack of accommodations in the region. The cave temples themselves, and there are a number of these, this type of activity began in central India, in such places as Ajanta. They are seen in Central Asian sites in the Kucha region, to which Buddhism was transmitted. And in China, they reappear in other Kansu cave groups, at Pinlinsu, Majushan. They reach colossal dimensions in the Shanxi, at Yunkan, and at Lungmen Cave. I spent some time at Luoyang, at Lung Men Cave, and there the sculptures and things were of tremendous impress. Among all of these, however, six great caves in China, the Thousand Buddha Caves, or the Cave 1,000 Buddhas of Dunhuang, has special value in art history and in documentary history because of the content of the cave behind the Buddha and the sculptures themselves. They are quantitatively the richest. The sculptured figures exceed 2,200, and over 1,400 of these retain fully their original condition. The first caves were developed sometime around 353 A.D., as far as they can get positive dating. So sometime after 300 A.D., the caves were occupied by individuals who eventually, their successors, were to develop this huge, tremendous outpouring and wealth of materials, both for Buddhist iconography as well as for doctrinal content. Now, the books that I brought back from China and Japan include every Buddhist site map for every one of the Buddhist temples and sites in all of China, Tibet, Mongolia, and the Turkestan areas, as well as the chronology and description of content of all of the caves. Then I have a number of translations of the Sogdian texts and the other texts from this ancient area. Qian was to be a vital area, milestone in my life. As I spent time in the city, there was a chemical engineer who became a guide for me. His name was Hua. We were able to visit one of the great pagoda temples in Qian, called the Big Goose Pagoda, with its temple sanctuaries. Since 1911, when the revolution took place and the dynasties of the ancient imperial families were reduced to mere citizens, and then following the Civil War before World War II, and then its culmination in 1949 with the incursion of communism, Chinese style, most of the religions of China were being eroded. In fact, during the Cultural Revolution of 8 years, which ended in 1976, nearly all religions had been reduced to practically ineffectual philosophy or teaching. Nearly every one of the great temples and temple sites throughout China had been reduced to museums. There were over 64 major Buddhist temples and 27 temples for nuns. There were 10 Taoist temples and 6 Taoist nun temples, 2 Muslim temples. One of the Muslim temples that I visited was one of the very few areas where there was still a little bit of autonomous religion going on. And then there were 4 temples of the Hortian group, little known sect. The question is always asked whenever I went to any of these sanctuaries, well, where are your ancient books? Where are your ancient scriptures? Where's the remnants of the materials that you once had? Stock answer, they were burned during the Cultural Revolution. One of the ways that they can reduce religion to being very ineffectual, it'd be very much the same thing here in the United States if they suddenly turned all of the Mormon temples into museums so you could do nothing in them ritually, put a caretaker on them and let the people come and go 24 hours of the day and nothing else could go on. That's what happened in China. Today there's nearly 1 billion Chinese. There's over 500 million of those who are between the age of 16 and 30. They're without religion of any kind. Hua himself was a young man during the war. His mother had been Christian. His father had been killed by the Japanese. His brother was finally killed. His mother, after 12 years of praying to a Christian God she tried to define for her son, died. As far as Hua was concerned, there was no God. In the Big Goose Pagoda, a marvelous structure, I took many pictures from the top of it. There were remnants, however, of some of the work of 2 great monks, one in particular, Yen, one of the great men in terms of religious history. Now, Yen lived at a period in China's history when he could receive support from the imperial house. Sometime around 700 AD, he came into Qian, this ancient city where I was staying. He had been in 30 countries and been gone for 25 years. He had returned with all kinds of books on almost all religions. And now he wanted to devote the balance of his life to translating all of this into Chinese. He was given then a sanctuary It was built after one that he had seen in India. And as the years traversed, he was able, with the help of others who became part of his group, to reduce most of the material he had brought into Chinese. They had not been burned. In the big goose pagoda, behind glass, dust-stained, easily seen that no one had been in for a long time, and apparently just fortuitously saved, were many of the volumes of the translations made by E.N. There was another particular sanctuary in Xi'an, where E.N. himself had had his own personal domicile. It was called the Small Goose Pagoda, but it had been damaged by an earthquake. When we visited that particular area, again, the sanctuary stretching for hundreds of yards, beautiful temples one after another, were part of a museum. People were coming and going. My questions again met the same blank stares. Where are the writings of E.N.? Where are all the books he brought with him? Where are the translations into Chinese? But in the Small Goose Pagoda, as Waugh tried to find out an answer to these, for he little knew the disposition of what may have happened, we finally isolated a particular caretaker of that sanctuary, a young girl in her 20s. She seemed to be a single person, but rather interested that a geologist of my own order would be interested in E.N., the ancient Chinese monk, a very well-known monk. So she gave him a key and told us to return to the first temple beyond the pagoda, that the earthquake that had damaged the pagoda had resulted in transference to the first sanctuary of many of the documents. We found the stairwell and the way up to the upper part of the temple, and there in an upper room, immaculately kept clean. I don't know by whom. There, to my great astonishment and fulfillment, were the works of E.N. Waugh was astonished as well as I. He was able easily to see the signature of E.N. on some of the documents. There was evidence that Japanese had been in the area years and years ago, and that the transmittal to many of the Buddhist sites throughout China and into Mongolia, Korea, and Japan had initiated from this center. There was materials indicating bibliography and data that had been brought back from Japan as part of the collections there. There was other paraphernalia and materials following the centuries of E.N. So now I know that in Xi'an, at least there, there are at least two temple sanctuaries and probably more in China, where from the first period of time, 200 A.D., to at least 710 A.D., right after E.N. had died in 705, that there were retained the translations from the ancient texts of the materials that had been brought from many world religions. What Dun Juan tells us in these ancient scriptures is that there has been an apostasy in Buddhism as great as one in Christianity. 52 Buddhist sects, 1981, and all of their offshoots, and Zen this and Zen that, have no comparison or parallel to Buddhism of the first three centuries after Buddha's demise. He died around 550 or so B.C., and for the first 300 years, a great deal of his teachings remained to a certain part unscathed, and then they began to add the bizarre and perverted material. E.N. himself, in the materials he collected nearly 1,000 years after the death of Buddha and brought into China, had to deal with bizarre material, unreliable materials, made selections, and then what was transmitted into China and elsewhere and finally into Japan was contaminated material, perverted and bizarre in many respects. And then that was further tampered with over the centuries until today, nearly 2,400 years after Buddha distilled his teachings, we do not have in modern Buddhism hardly anything that reflects earlier Buddhism. Earlier Buddhism, as we'll read to you from some of the documents, has very interesting parallels to Mormonism. At any rate, there in the sanctuary of E.N., our final summation the Chinese guide, the chemical engineer, and myself, when he brought out the final blurted exclamation, "How will I ever know there's a God?" And I was impressed in that moment to tell him, "You will know there is a God when the Mormons build a temple in China." I was so impressed to understand that there would be a temple built in China that after I arrived back in the United States, I provided a substantial gift to the temple fund earmarked for the Chinese temple. As far as I know, I'm the first one to donate specifically to the Chinese temple. It was received without question. The church has been microfilming all the genealogical records in China since early part of 1981, as far as I've been able to determine. And things are in progress that'll be most exciting. Instructions are being given, things are being planned, and I have no doubt that one of the 80 temples on the drawing board of the church, if not immediately there, there will be soon the Chinese temple. Then, Wah, if it's in his lifetime, because he's still a young man, he may come to know there's a God. More important, however, is that in southwest China, western China, along the Lop Nor Desert, Chinese Turkestan, that there are remnants of much of the gospel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Let me refer to a few of those particular discoveries that are being made, and you can draw your own conclusion. In the Lop Nor Desert, there is a cemetery at Astana in Central Asia. Ariel Steen, who visited that particular one during one of his expeditions in his activities associated with Dunhuang, happened to be one to enter this tomb and describe it. The woman in the tomb had been buried 8 December 667. Her husband had been added to the tomb in 689 A.D. There was a veil in the tomb, and there was also a very interesting Sasanian art form there. The description comes from Steen himself. "In the veil in question, what first catches the eye are the signs of the square and the compass. Silk, perhaps originally white, seems to have been what the two individuals were dressed in. The bodies rise from a continuous flounce-like shirt, white skirt, and there's an apron. Their two inner arms stretched stiffly and horizontally toward each other, the hand of one, hand of each appearing under the opposite armpit of the other, shows that they were placed in the act of embracing. The desert of Lop Nor is as good a mummifying activity as if Egypt ever was. Fuhisi holds in his uplifted hand a mason square. A Nuwas holds in her right hand a pair of compasses. And from below issue two intertwining serpentine bodies which coil around each other. This is the well-known caduceus of life and death, signifying that all things have their opposites. Part of the art form, there's a design completely surrounded with diagrams of the constellations, while above the heads of the two figures is a sun disk, white with red spokes, surrounded by 12 smaller circles." In some of the epic material and the documents being translated into English, I have several here that I can refer to. One tells us of a very ancient form of a word of wisdom. It describes the partaking of wine and intoxicating liquor in a rather interesting form. It describes also that if one does so, he will not be protected. Remember 89 section verse 21. It also talks about the character and nature of an individual who does imbibe. It doesn't mention tobacco, tea, or coffee because those things are developed after the 14th century. So this ancient form of a word of wisdom is rather interesting. Some of the doctrines and documents also talk of the directions which are full of Buddhas who are walking and provisions of worship and a great assembly of gods where one is surrounded with honor and respect. This great assembly shines on in such a manner that leads one to believe that the provisions of worship are provided where one might join that assembly. Many of you have probably read the book Added Upon. Added Upon is sort of a story where the principles of salvation or the plan of salvation is kind of worked out so an individual can follow it in story form. Likewise, among the Hindus and the Buddhists, there was an ancient form that did the very same thing. They called it the Mahabharata. It would do for the ancients of those days the same thing it added upon the little book would do for us, or Saturday Night's Warriors, along that line, interpreting it for everyone. There are some contents of the Mahabharata and its associated texts that are most interesting and exciting. Let me lead up to it by some of the comparative studies of what we call the ascension motive, or how to get into heaven. God often gave the righteous a foretaste of heaven by bringing them up for a look. We find that in the case of Joseph Smith, Paul, and others, and likewise Harada, a seer in the Mahabharata, is taken up to heaven and given a look at the kingdoms. There's also some material found in the Quran and other of the Jewish writings, and one found in Egypt as well as in Russia, recently known as the Apocalypse and the Testament of Abraham, which Hugh Nibley uses in his book extensively on the Abraham and Egypt account. The rabbis interpreted this ascension that God showed him the streets of heaven and that God lifted him up about the vault of heaven. In the Quran, it stated that God showed Abraham the kingdom of the heavens and the earth, and that he might be of those possessing certainty. The same intent was provided for Harada and others in these great epics found among the ancient materials now of China and India. In the Apocalypse of Abraham, for example, which is a Jewish work, Abraham is carried aloft by the angel. In heaven, he is given a vision of the pre-mortal life wherein certain ones were foreordained to be of Abraham's lineage. He is also given a vision of that which will occur at the end of days, when 10 plagues will affect mankind. Among these plagues are hunger, conflagration, earthquakes, and much snow. Kind of interesting in that respect. The Shepherd of Hermes is another document found in Turfan, China, and part of the Dunhuang documents. This is Christian material. Among the Buddhist materials were many of the Manichaean documents, both in Turfan, China, and at Dunhuang. The Shepherd of Hermes speaks of baptism for these departed souls. And Clement of Alexandria, in referring to the Shepherd of Hermes, extended salvation to the Gentiles as well as the ancient Israel prophets, so that all would receive salvation. There are other writings as well dealing with Christ's descent into hell to preach and save the spirits there. There's an epistle called the Epistle of the Apostles, the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, Dan and Benjamin, also found among the Dead Sea Scrolls and elsewhere, and the Ascension of Isaiah, and the Sibylline Oracles, and the Odes of Solomon. The Odes of Solomon are found in Turfan, China, and among some of the Mandean and the Manichaean sources. These all become linked. What Ian was bringing back was a distillation of the best that he found in all these ancient religions, not the least of which was Judaism and Christianity, and early forms from the first and second century doctrines as well. There's even teachings that the prophet and John the Baptist continued their earthly ministries into the spirit world with the dead. A rather interesting parallel there to certain Mormon claims. Now, the Rig Veda, which is one of the literatures of India, also found at Turfan and elsewhere in the discoveries at Dunhuang, there's an account of the ancient sage who enters the underworld governed by Lord Varuna. He enters the other world on a boat, which is a common theme that Dimbly's found in many areas, Egypt and elsewhere. As a result of this experience, he becomes a prophet. He has seen things. The other account is equally nebulous. This is the famous hymn found in the Rig Veda, where Kisin describes himself as beings belonging to Arjuna. In one of the suttas, another one of the Buddhist teachings, it states that some monks are capable of gaining access to the world of the gods. One of these monks who gained access was a man called Aniruddha. He ascended into the Brahman Loka. The Buddha taught that there is one way for the purification of beings, for the extinction of unhappiness and depression, and for the acquisition of right method and for the realization of heaven. That one way is a cultivation of the four major paths. One must eliminate desire, aversion for the world with reference to the body, sensations of the body, mental thought, and the phenomena of the world. One does this by removing five obstacles: pleasure, evil, stupidity, vanity, and uncertainty, We could do very well to copy that in great detail. In fact, we do in one form or another. It is that knowledge which is more sure, says ancient Buddhist texts, more real, more true, which is based on experience and not just reasoning. It is a witness which one gains and which the monks and the nuns shared. These ancient texts talk about this great liberation that comes with knowledge. He will gain it during his life and then keep it as a deeper god in the next world. It's difficult to interpret a given symbol from another culture in terms of the interpretation given for that symbol, but nevertheless, we still find many interesting parallels from each of these various sources and areas. There are several similarities that find their way into some of the experiences found throughout the world. Among these is the idea that there are several heavens and hells, not just one. These heavens are actual places in which living people dwell. They're not just various levels of the firmament. The individuals must change form, however, or be given special garments which protect him, or have his vision changed into a heavenly vision if he's to be permitted to see any of these properly. And then if he's changed into a heavenly vision, it permits him to see without being blinded. Life is conscious and there's active life. Further, there is progress to be made during the life in the hereafter. In short, death is not the end of life, but a beginning. Change of scenery. There is a third function for the ascension, besides those of personal benefit, and that's for aiding the individual and in preparing for death and the life to come. Now, a student of these things, George Windegren, gives the following statement regarding the ideal ritual and how to get to heaven. First, you must know the way. Then there's a presentation before God, clothing in a garment. Then a crown is involved. You must have a certain name. There must be the secret name and the proclamation as the elect. There's an enthronement, God on the seat, and gift of knowledge of God's own doing, communion by drinking from God's own cup, the union with God, the elevation to the divine state, and then a special commission. You've got to go back and help somebody else. This ascension motive in these ancient texts is called the Rajasuya. It is without doubt an ascension ritual actually accomplished. The very first element of this ascension into heaven ritual is called the praenia. Really, this just means ascension, getting into heaven. The king is clothed in sacred garments. The garment is connected with all the gods, says an ancient text. The garments are said to be marked in special ways. Representative of the ceremony undertaken by the king, the garment consists of several parts, one of which is worn on the head, the ends of which are tied into the upper garment. Throughout the ritual, the king is called by the name of the various gods whom he is impersonating. He is taken back into primordial time, performs the same function symbolically which the gods and the first king did at that time, by virtue of which they attained heaven. The king is then enthroned on a throne, which is addressed as being the navel of kingship and the cosmos. He's given a kingdom of his own. The king is given God's special knowledge in the form of learning those things which occurred before and which lead to the gods becoming that which they have become. There's also another epic, the one I referred to earlier, the Mahabharata. It also has another function. For example, Narada, an ancient seer, Vedic Rishi, was coursing through the heavenly worlds, visiting the various levels of heaven, and discoursing with inhabitants thereof. It sounds like the 76th section at times. He describes the various heavens and the people who inhabit them. He then visits the lowest heavens. It's called the heaven of the fathers. They are the ancestors of those then living on earth. One of these fathers was a former king named Pandu. He had a special request to make of Narada. After Pandu's death in the Mahabharata, he left five sons. So here's what he says. If Narada were to meet with his five sons when he returned to the earth, would he please ask those sons to perform the Rajasuya in behalf of their father? If they would, said Pandu, then he would be able to advance to the highest heaven where God dwells. If thou performest that sacrifice, thou shalt then be able to go, along with the deceased ancestors, into the same region that is inhabited by the God or chief of the immortals. So then, this information is carried back in the Mahabharata to the five sons. They perform that sacrifice in behalf of their dead ancestor, their father. Well, it's evident from this account that the Rajasuya, while being primarily a ritual for the benefit of the living, can be, if performed accordingly, a ritual in behalf of one's ancestors. In other words, it has vicarious value as well as value for the living. It is part of those documents that were brought back by E.N. The sole purpose of Jesus descending into hell was to teach the inhabitants and release them from their bondage so they might gain access to heaven. At any rate, the Buddha ascended into the heaven for the sole purpose of teaching his mother. This was another one of the episodes where Buddha himself goes into the heaven because his mother had died when he was just 7 days old and therefore had not heard the gospel her son was proclaiming on earth. The individual receives his ascension calling so that he might learn the secrets of regaining the souls of those who are sick or dead. Buddha, apparently, in this long misunderstood ritual, was doing something we can understand as Latter-day Saints for his mother. As in the case of the Buddha, and as indicated of Abraham, the whole series of experiences provided in these ancient documents that were experienced by others was to remove all uncertainty or doubt. The individual is given a knowledge to sustain him through his earthly life. It must be one of the most exquisite and soul-inspiring messages written deep on the heart and mind of the righteous who is entitled to such an experience. Why then, the Latter-day Saints who have so much, they have it all, aren't we, somehow or another, getting an indelible, exquisite, and soul-inspiring message written deep in our hearts so that we can carry this message to the rest of the world and involve them in this great work? Well, in the Doctrine and Covenants 76 section, it does say, "But great and marvelous are the works of the Lord, and the mysteries of his kingdom, which he showed unto us, which surpassed all understanding in glory, in might, and in dominion, which he commanded us we should not write while we're yet in the Spirit, and are not lawful for men to utter. Neither is a man capable to make them known, for they are only to be seen and understood by the power of the Holy Spirit, which God bestows on those who love him and purify themselves before him, to whom he grants this privilege of seeking, seeing, and knowing for themselves, that through the power and manifestation of Spirit while in the flesh, they may be able to bear his presence in the world of glory." Many of these ancient priests and seers course through the heavenly worlds in a rather unusual manner. In some of the texts that I have here, just some excerpt might be of interest to you. The chief figure in the Mahabharata passes through crises of faith to make a personal act of faith and to live faithful to his ideals. This faith is the eternal heaven, eternal life. We had translated it as exaltation, or as much as he could perceive of it. Through such a faithful life of striving, he would achieve perfection. Dharma was perfection. The idea of heaven becomes clear in the great epic, says D. Ryan in 1976 in some translating material. The idea was presented of the possibility of sharing the heavenly world of a divine being whose presence is so characteristic of that place, so that you actually go and there share it. He is also said to obtain everlasting worlds. This idea of achieving a heavenly world does not seem to have an explanation in the traditional motives of the scholars working on it. They don't quite understand that. And yet I think we can readily see what it's all about. The popular material that comes from Dun Juan also conveyed to the ordinary individuals. This is called the Pinwin. It's sort of, again, an enlarged and expanded, added upon. Several references from it might be of interest in talking about the heavens and the worlds, because they talked about the next world systems, and references were made to the next world systems, and worlds in all directions. The only instance in the stories where one of the other worlds is referred to is the story of the king of Abharati, which is the name of one of the worlds. It is one of the other worlds in the cosmology. It's located to the east of the world. And this idea of many worlds, that you could have a kingdom of worlds, and there were inhabitants like ourselves on these other worlds, and then there were kingdoms of glory and various other deep compartments of hell are found in these ancient documents. Now, as we skip along, we might mention one or two of the other areas here. We mentioned the one particular dealing with the equivalent of the 89th section of Doctrine and Covenants. Maybe a little bit more detail might be of interest to you. One does not acquire the divine body because he has always fallen into three evil ways. Intoxicating drink is like fire, for it burns all good deeds and kindles all evil actions. On account of drunkenness, the splendid body becomes despicable. The Lord loses power. The wise man loses wisdom. The man of good repute accordingly becomes infamous, and the rich man turns poor and becomes ridiculous and abhorrent to all living beings. Therefore, one should not drink intoxicating drink. Also, intoxicating drink makes the eyes dim, the tongue awry, the ears deaf, the hands feeble, and it deflects the feet and imperceptibly leads to death. There's no protection from death if you get involved. Now, it is entirely reprehensible. Therefore, one should not drink intoxicating drink. Rather, let a man drink molten copper than intoxicating drink. That might be effective if individuals who have problem with drinking on a serious level and are destructive, give them a choice. Have them drink molten copper. For this molten copper burns the body of one existence, but intoxicating drink burns existence after existence. It literally wipes you out spiritually. You lose all. Now, whoever may understand the harm of intoxicating drink, this ancient document says, the path of enlightenment will henceforth be grasped by him. On this account, one should not drink intoxicating drink. For he understands and takes it falsely so that he is far removed from the path of enlightenment, should he so participate. There's a lot of things along that line that are unique where Mormonism is concerned. One of the more recent studies by James Boyd that has now become available in 1975 has to do with a comparison between the individual called Satan and Mara. Symbols so parallel in Christianity and in Buddhism. Now, this is ancient Buddhism, but the interesting thing is that we do not find some of the activities of Mara, a counterpart in the satanic understanding of the traditional Christian churches. Here are some of the things that Mara does in the early Buddhist tradition. The deeds of Mara. He reviles, inclines towards sense. He's sensual, desires, he attacks, abuses, vexes, annoys. He inclines towards sense desires. He attacks. He confuses. He perplexes. He obstructs. He interrupts. He possesses and holds in bondage. He kills and he destroys. There are many devils. There are Mara Devas, singular and plural. There's also association of Mara with terms of analysis. There's a great formula. He is also the lord of the world of desire. He has cosmological status and abode. And there is a realm of power, but there will be ultimate defeat of him. Latter-day Saints pretty well understand that the adversary, the equivalent of the Mara, Satan or Lucifer, had power in authority cosmologically in the presence of God, according to the 76th section of Doctrine and Covenants. And so when we understand Satan's powers and compare them to Mara, the traditional comparison goes beyond just Christian comparison. It borders on confirmation of Mormon understanding of the adversary. There's also types of redemption, which is another study that's just become available in 1970. And one of these has to do with a study of grace and freedom in the way of salvation in some of the early Buddhism, it's particularly in Japanese Buddhism. And so there's a great deal now being written in terms of the early, first millennium Buddhism. The Dunhuan texts now are demanding a reassessment of all of Buddhism. There's a renewal now, an effort to go back. One of the largest societies of Buddhism in the world is headed by a man called Ikeda. He himself now has put out several texts and books on the living Buddha and the first centuries of ancient Buddhism. and an effort is being made to correspond in teachings. There's also a monastic discipline on Buddhistic materials going back to the Sanskrit, very early materials. In fact, there's two significant Buddhist monastic disciplinary texts available now for the first time, translated in English. These go back to the 4th century B.C. And here we find many parallels to the life of Buddha and the teachings of Jesus Christ. The holy teachings also, Velma Lakirti, deals with Mahanya scripture, and there's parallels there that need to be examined in terms of Mormonism today. A few final statements then concerning Buddhism. 600 years before Christianity was ever heard of under the name Christianity, Buddha taught a doctrine of salvation and attainment in the form suitable to a vastly different racial intellect than that of the Jews, to whom the Christian scriptures are primarily addressed. Yet these teachings of the Buddha are in no wise different from the teachings of these later scriptures. The Buddha also taught a morality in all respects the same as that which Jesus presented, and certainly more consistently practiced by his followers, and very close and parallel to the Mormon concept of morality, word of wisdom, and so forth, and commitment. And it's the Buddha's teachings concerning the ascension into heaven, their rituals and their rites, and other practices that find no counterpart in Christianity today at all, but they are found in Mormonism. We fairly well exhausted the books that I have here on Buddhism. There's one, Faith and Knowledge in Early Buddhism. Many new studies now coming out of European scholars. Going back to the Second Council, evidently around 400 B.C. that was held by the ancient Buddhists. An unshakable freedom of will was understood then, and life was a beginning. There was also a council held 383 B.C., during which the Buddhist message grew, was systematized and fixed in the different discourses and suttas. Rediscovering ancient Buddhism is like rediscovering ancient Christianity. Again, it's the Book of Mormon statement there that the Lord gave to all nations in their own tongue, in their own language, sufficient for their needs. But to the Latter-day Saint, it would seem to indicate that the Turkestan area, Chinese Turkestan, Western China, and Southern Mongolia, and the Northern Tibetan areas may know more about Mormonism than any other people on earth except the Mormons themselves. And that when we get into Western China, we'll find a people prepared. And if nothing else, when liberty permits and freedom, translations will be made again of the ancient Chinese documents, and these will permit confirmation that they once possessed a lot of this knowledge. Who were the Wusan people of Chinese Turkestan? Indo-European in language. Could they have been Ephraim? 95% of all the Chinese and Japanese who are receiving patriarchal blessings are told they are of Ephraim. We are Ephraim on the face of the earth. The work will go forth to all the nations. The great untouched nations now are Russia and China. And apparently our brethren are there, our brothers and sisters. One out of every four persons on the face of the earth is Chinese. I bear you my testimony. The church will prosper there. A temple will be built there. And my friend Hua will know there's a God, because the Mormons will prevail in China. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.